Cicero, the great Roman philosopher, orator, and statesman, has some advice for you. Old age can be the best time of life if you live wisely. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Philip Freeman, a classics professor at Luther College, who's bringing the wisdom of Cicero to a new generation with his translation of How to Grow Old. In 44 BC, Cicero shared advice on love, lust, exercise, learning, relationships, and even gardening. Philip Freeman also has a new novel out featuring a scrappy 6th century Irish nun who solves mysteries. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we will share in the wisdom of Cicero, the great Roman philosopher and statesman. We'll also meet a scrappy 6th century Irish nun who solves mysteries, both thanks to Philip Freeman, a classics professor at Luther College. He has recently released a new translation of Cicero's How to Grow Old and the novel Sacrifice, his second novel to feature our heroic nun. And he is here with me now. Hello, Philip.
Hello, how are you doing?
Great, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
And I want to start with Cicero. You have released this translation of his work, and this is a book that he wrote, obviously, a very, very long time ago, 44 BC, right?
Yeah, that's right, just the same year that Caesar was assassinated.
All right, and this is a book that has been translated many times. What brought this work to your attention?
Well, what really happened, I read this, of course, when I was an undergraduate many years ago in Latin, but I was 18 years old. Of course, it didn't mean that much to me then. But then a few years ago, I turned 50, and it started to, I remembered it. And then I taught it now and then in class, and I realized just what a wonderful, timeless book it is about growing older.
Tell us about Cicero for those of us who didn't spend a lot of time in classics courses in college.
Cicero was a Roman politician who lived during the most exciting time, I think, of Roman history, which is the first century BC. It was a time of terrible civil wars. It was the rise of tyrants like Pompey the Great and then Julius Caesar, and the start of the Roman Empire as well. And Cicero was there for all of it. He was born in 106 BC and then lived until just a few years after Cicero himself died. And he was a great observer, a tremendous orator, a very concerned politician, and a transmitter of the wisdom of the Greeks to the Roman world.
And this work seems to have arisen from what we might describe as a midlife crisis. What do we know about why he wrote this?
It was. He was in his early 60s when he wrote it. And he had divorced from a wife he'd been married to many years. He'd remarried, divorced again. His beloved daughter had recently died, and he was out of the picture in politics. Caesar had taken over. And so Cicero had retired to the countryside and was looking for something to do with his life, looking for some sort of a comfort. He felt alone. And so he turned to the philosophy of the Greeks for wisdom and added a lot of his own practical common sense.
And the book that he wrote is not really a how-to guide. It's not the kind of advice that we might think of today, but he created a fictional dialogue. How did he do this?
He did. He wrote, the book is set in the year 150 BC, so it's set a number of years before Cicero himself was even born. But he has a dialogue between an old man and between two of the old man's friends. And the old man, whose name is Cato the Elder, is talking with two younger men named Scipio and Laelius, and they say, Cato, how is it that you are in your 80s and you seem to be happy and doing well in life? We want to learn how to do it. And so the rest of the dialogue, and it pretty much is just a lecture after that, the rest of it is about what you need to do in order to be happy and growing older.
Why would he have chosen, obviously it was a long time ago, so we can't know exactly, but why would he have chosen these fictional characters?
Well, he was a great admirer of Scipio. There were two Scipios, the younger and the older, and this is the older Scipio. This Scipio was a traditional Roman in every way, and yet was open to new ideas. He learned Greek as an old man, and he just was the sort of person that Cicero himself admired. And he also admired the two younger characters in the book as well. And what he's really doing is following the whole dialogue format that Plato really made famous with his Socratic dialogues.
So his reading of Greek works influenced his writing of this work.
Oh, very much. The Greeks had written about old age. There's some wonderful poetry by the Greek poet Sappho, which has just actually recently in the last few years been rediscovered in papyrus from Egypt. She talks about growing older. So Cicero was building on all of this, but it's not just that he transmits old Greek ideas. He passes on a lot of the wisdom of the Greeks, but he adds some, as I said, practical Roman sensibility to it all.
Now, when I think about ancient Rome, I don't think about people living a long time. And old age doesn't necessarily strike me as a problem that a lot of people in the ancient world had. What was the life expectancy?
Well, that's a funny thing. And I grew up, too, and always thought that, in the ancient Roman times, people, if they were lucky, lived into their 40s. It's not really true. The average lifespan was in the 30s or 40s, but that takes into account a very high infant and child mortality rate. If you could survive childhood, if you could make it out of those first 5 or 6 years, you stood a decent chance of living into your 60s, 70s, or even 80s. It wasn't unusual to find people in their 90s and even some who were over 100 years old.
How do we know about Cicero's midlife crisis, as I described it? Where is the record that tells us he got a divorce and he spent time with a younger woman and then he was alone?
Well, the wonderful thing about Cicero, aside from writing these great philosophical dialogues, he wrote letters, especially to his best friend Atticus, and he describes these. It's almost like reading a diary of Cicero, and so we get an insight into the inner workings of the mind of Cicero, really like nobody else. We certainly don't get this from Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great. But we know what was going on in detail in Cicero's life because he himself told us.
I mean, it's remarkable that those letters were preserved.
They were, and they were very popular to be read. I mean, Cicero, I think, wanted them to be read. He collected them together, but they were preserved throughout the Middle Ages, into the Renaissance, and into the modern time. And Cicero really is just one of the most influential figures of ancient history and one of the most read. When you look at the history of Western European civilization and American civilization, people read Cicero. Our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, were huge Cicero fans. And so much of our government is the whole idea of the division of power. That really comes from Cicero.
And this work itself was a favorite of our founding fathers, right?
It was. John Adams was a particular favorite of it. As he grew older, he read it again and again. And of course, back then, they read it in Latin because they were all very well trained in that. But nowadays, not everyone can read Latin, so I decided to translate it into English. Although I do keep the Latin on the left side of the page for anybody who wants to practice.
Right. I chose not to read the Latin part. One of the interesting things about the book is that he spends quite a bit of time talking about lust or the pleasures of the flesh, which I don't know, maybe if you think about advice for growing older is not a topic that you think might come up. Would you read for us a little bit from one of the sections that he touches on the sensual pleasures?
Sure. Would you like it in English or Latin?
English, please.
Oh, okay. All right. He says this. Why am I talking so much about pleasure? Because the fact that old age feels little desire for sensual delights is not only no cause for reproach, but indeed a reason to praise it highly. Old age has no extravagant banquets, no tables piled high, no wine cups filled again and again, but it also has no drunkenness, no indigestion, and no sleepless nights. And then he goes on to talk about why sex really is overrated, and it's how it's so much better to be old. And he doesn't discount sexual pleasure among older people at all. But he says it takes a proper proportion, a proper place in your life once you reach a certain age.
So that sounds like, again, the result of his midlife crisis, because clearly, if we are going to think of him in modern terms, he was driven by the desires of the flesh as he ended his 30-year marriage and took up with a much younger woman.
Yes, indeed. And that didn't, of course, as usually happens, that didn't work out very well. So he was despondent when that marriage to the younger woman failed. And so he decided to turn to philosophy.
As so many of us do, right? The advice given in the book does seem to be still very relevant to all of us. I mean, one of the things that he comes back to again and again, though, seems a little unfair. If I'm picking this up as an older person in middle age or past, and I'm thinking, you know, I want to gain some wisdom from this, one of the points that he drives home over and over again is that to have a good old age, you need to begin when you're young.
Yes, indeed. He says this, that you really need to start when you're young with proper training, proper thinking, proper philosophy. It's not something you can just go wild and have fun until one day you wake up as a 65-year-old and then decide you're going to get serious about life. You have to do it while you're younger. And it doesn't mean you have to learn Greek and Latin and all of that. But he means that you have to take moral responsibility seriously, and intellectual creativity and curiosity seriously from a young age. And of course, if you don't, it's going to be harder, but it's not going to be impossible for you to have a good old age. But it really helps if you begin when you're young.
The way the book is structured as a dialogue between an old man and younger men, do you think that indicates that he was thinking of an audience of younger people for this book?
I think he was. He was very much interested. He always liked being around younger people. So I think he was interested in writing to young Roman men in their 20s and 30s, especially. It's funny, he goes through this whole book without ever really mentioning women, which is a fairly typical thing for Cicero to do. It just didn't occur to him.
And a typical thing for Romans.
Indeed. But yes, he is writing this, I think, primarily for younger people, but also for older people.
Do we know who would have read it? Was it a popular book when it was published?
Oh, it was. It was read by Cicero in general, was very popular for the next 400, 500 years of the Roman Empire and into the Middle Ages. It was a required book for schoolboys to read, certainly. But when I read it when I was 18, I certainly didn't care about anything he had to say in here. I was just reading it because the Latin professors told me I had to. But it was, you do hear about people, mostly older people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, reading it and being very impressed and very moved by what he had to say.
We're going to take a short break. We will be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Philip Freeman. Philip Freeman is a classics professor at Luther College. He's the author of many books, and he's just released a new translation of Cicero's How to Grow Old. He also has a new novel out. It's called Sacrifice, and it's the second novel to feature a heroic 6th century Irish nun. We'll talk more about that later on as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Philip Freeman. He's a classics professor at Luther College, author of many books, and most recently, he has released a translation of a book by Cicero, the great Roman philosopher and statesman. It's How to Grow Old, Ancient Wisdom for the Second Half of Life. And just before the break, we were talking about some of the wisdom that Cicero shared in this book that was written in 44 BC. And one of the interesting things that we find in the book, as I mentioned, it seems like his audience is intended for younger people. And there is this dialogue in the book that takes place between an old man and two younger men. And he also wants us to take away from this that young people should listen to old people and that old people should also listen to young people.
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So what it struck me as interesting that he wanted that to be not just that old people should be able to share their wisdom, but that young people should also be able to share their thoughts and their experiences with older people. What do you take away from that?
Well, yeah, he certainly does take the idea seriously that younger people have something to teach older people and to just, if nothing else, to lend them their energy. Which I think is true. I know, I think of my own grandfather in his later years. He talked about how he really loved to be around young people. He got very tired of being around people his own age sometime, and he wanted just to go out and have dinner with people in their 20s and 30s. And Cicero would agree that younger people have a lot to teach older people, but that older people certainly do have something to teach younger people as well, if only you can get younger people to listen. I can't get my kids to listen, but certainly somebody out there must.
Maybe eventually. One of the things that I also found really delightful about the book is that so much of his advice dovetails exactly with the advice that's given to older people today, that you know, people have been doing studies and research to come up with information about keeping our minds active and helping us avoid dementia in old age. And he gives the exact same advice that the people give today, and that is that the mind is a muscle that must be exercised. What does he have to say on that front?
Well, he talks about the speaker in this dialogue, Cato, learning Greek when he got older, which is no easy achievement. And he talks about people who practice law and do all sorts of intellectual activities into their 70s and 80s and 90s. And he says it's just crucial that you have to exercise the mind, because it is a muscle. And if it is a muscle that you don't use, becomes flabby and eventually useless. So he says, yes, the body is not able to do everything that it could, but the mind really can if you use it.
And that dovetails also with, as he's talking about, that there are different things that you do in different times of life. He seems to be taking the long view, that you don't have to rush and do everything as a young person because there is time later.
Oh, absolutely. He says that there are seasons in life. And I think this is great wisdom. There are things that you do when you're a child that you don't do when you're an adolescent or when you're a young adult or a middle-aged person or an old person. And that's proper and that's good. Cicero says there's nothing sadder than watching a person who is middle-aged trying to act like they're in their 20s. And we can see that every day. And not only is it sad, but it just doesn't work. You have to align yourself with the you wear a coat during the wintertime here in Iowa. You adjust to the seasons, and likewise, you adjust to the seasons of life if you want to be happy.
And something else that sounds like it's straight out of the Journal of American Medicine today is that older people should exercise.
Absolutely. And he says, first of all, you have to be aware that you are not going to be able to run a marathon as fast as you could when you were in your 20s, but that physical activity is important, just like mental activity is. You just have to adjust things a little bit.
And he goes on at some length about that. Of course, he goes on at some length about a lot of things. And one of the things that he talks for a very long time about is farming or gardening. And thankfully, you tipped me off that this was supposed to be a little bit funny, because I'm not sure I would have picked up on that. And maybe when you were 18 years old, did you read that as funny?
No, I read it as tedious. There is a long section in here about farming, and you know, it's my opinion that it's supposed to be a little bit tongue in cheek, but not totally. Cicero goes on and on about the joys of farming, and I think you could take this very literally as growing things or as gardening. I know many of the best gardeners in Iowa are older people. But I think you could take this as a metaphor, too, that you have to, Molière says, that you have to cultivate your own garden. And I think that that's a important thing you have to do. And maybe that garden is sowing or walking or reading or whatever it might be. But you need some sort of an activity, some passion when you're older that you can devote yourself to, because that makes all the difference.
Now, of course, as we age, a lot of us spend a lot of time thinking about death, and he devotes a significant portion of the book to his thoughts on death. And I would love for you to read us a little bit from that section as well.
Okay. We must finally consider the fourth objection to growing old, an objection that seems especially calculated to cause worry and distress to a man of my years. I speak of the nearness of death. When a person is old, there is certainly no doubt that death cannot be far away. Wretched indeed is the man who, in the course of a long life, has not learned that death is nothing to be feared, for death either completely destroys the human soul, in which case it is negligible, or takes the soul to a place where it can live forever, which makes it desirable. There is no third possibility. That's at least according to Cicero. There are probably all sorts of other possibilities, but Cicero says basically that we shouldn't be afraid of death, that he compares life frequently to a play, to a drama, and he says that there is a time that you have to step off the stage. And for those actors who don't know when to leave the stage, again, it's a very sad thing. There are different seasons, and as much as we don't like to think about it, that death is one of those seasons of life.
It's interesting because he does seem to be so at peace with the idea of death and the juxtaposition of there's either an afterlife or there's not. That's okay. That seems like a very peaceful thing to feel.
It
but
is.
Of course, a lot of people who believe that there's an afterlife also think that there is a chance that you might be punished for things that you did
in
your life. And he doesn't really address that at all.
He very conveniently leaves that part out. And certainly there were people in the ancient world who believed in a life of punishment too, Christian or not.
Right. Well, they go deeply into it.
Yes.
We know all about the underworld.
Oh, yes. You can read Dante and find all
right.
about a third possibility. But there
are several levels of that possibility, right?
Yes, indeed. So he there are. But I think, you know, it is true that he holds this in his mind that death is nothing to be feared in any case, that it's really going to be okay.
And he does seem to believe that there is an afterlife.
He does. After he says this, talks about these two possibilities, he says, not everybody believes this, but I believe that there is an afterlife, that it is a pleasant one, that it is a time of reunion, a time of growth even. And something that we really shouldn't be afraid of, because it's better than we could ever imagine.
We've talked about how this book was very popular for a long time. It was something that our founding fathers turned to. Benjamin Franklin even published a version of it, right?
Yes. This book, De Senectute, or On Old Age, was the first classical work published in the United States, or in what would become the United States, by Benjamin Franklin.
As writers or readers turn to it so often, do we know, are there other works that seem to be inspired by this?
You know, I don't know of any particular works that grow directly out of this, but there are plenty. I mean, well, there are plenty of other Cicero's works that inspire the writings and essays of all sorts of people. But in a way, it's almost like later writers say, "Yeah, Cicero got it. He said it all." And just, you know, read him. There's not a whole lot more that I really need to say about this.
So what does it mean to you now at this point in your life? I mean, you said it didn't mean a whole lot when you were 18, although he was trying to instruct you at that young age.
And I wasn't listening
age,
at all.
Right?
You know? Well, I'm 54 years old. So and when I turned 50 a few years ago, I decided it was time for me to have a midlife crisis. I think I needed to either buy a red sports car or find a mistress or something, but I couldn't afford a sports car, and I loved my wife, so I decided to read this book again, and to read it in Latin and to really listen to it. And I am so impressed by what Cicero has to say, and especially this idea that there are proper seasons in life. Because, you know, look at the latest Hollywood news or watch people getting Botox injections and, you know, desperately trying to look younger, to feel younger. And it's just not going to work in the end, that you really have to accept. I mean, I look at my face in the morning and, you know, I look at my hands and I don't look 18 anymore. And I could either get really upset about that or I could just say, well, that's okay. I'm in a different season of life now.
There seem to be conflicting messages from philosophers about that, though, because obviously life can be short and we never know when it might end. So many many pieces of wisdom come to us to say, you know, live each day to the fullest, carpe diem, you know. And he's seeming to say it's okay to do what is front of you in front of you right now, and there will be time.
Yes, and he's. I think Cicero would agree with that about living each moment, and what Horace later said, "Carpe diem," about seize the day. I think that he would agree that you certainly have to seize the day, whether you're 20 or 60 or 80 or 100, but that you have to seize it in a way appropriate to that season of your life. I think what he was saying. And if you're 85 years old and you've never parachuted before and you really want to do that, well, go ahead. But realize that it might be a bit of a harder landing than it was when you were 18.
I'm talking to Philip Freeman. He's recently released a new translation of How to Grow Old by Marcus Tullius Cicero, who is the great Roman philosopher and statesman. And it's full of wisdom for the latter part of life, although intended perhaps once upon a time for young readers. I'm curious, you talked about being in that classics class when you were in college. When did you first develop an interest in the ancient world and in the classics?
I think it was probably when I was in high school is when I never took Latin in high school, unlike most people in my profession, but I loved ancient history. And so I got interested in it then. And then in college, I went to the University of Texas and I studied Latin and I studied Greek. And honestly, I wasn't a natural at it. I had to work very hard to learn it. But I just developed this passion for the past and seeing the Greek and the Roman foundation of so much of what we do, whether it's just the English language or whether it's American government or art or architecture, whatever it might be. And so what I try to do, what all of us in my job as a classicist try to do, is to pass that on to college students and to the general public, and so that they can really see that life didn't begin just a few years ago, that there's a long heritage behind us all that shapes us more than we know.
A lot of kids go through kind of a phase where they're interested, at least, in Greek mythology or the Roman gods, or even thinking about the Roman Empire. For some kids, that becomes one of those sort of intense interests, kind of like dinosaurs. But you were not one of those kids.
Well, I always liked mythology, that's for sure. But no, I really wasn't one of those kids. And my father was in the Air Force, and we were stationed in Italy when I was in middle school. And we had Roman ruins all around us, and it really didn't grab me all that much. I was much more interested in Boy Scouts and bowling with my friends than I was wandering around archaeological sites. But no, it really got a hold of me in high school and then really particularly in college.
Do you remember the first thing that really grabbed you and made you want to dig a lot deeper?
I remember reading Homer. To tell you the truth, when I was, I think, a freshman in college, I read the Iliad and the Odyssey for the first time, especially the Odyssey. And it is just a stunning book. I recommend it to anybody out there who wants to read a great, gripping book. It is not stuffy at all. And it has everything in it that you can imagine about love and death and honor and sorrow and murder. It's just everything is there. And it's just one of the earliest stories in Western literature, but it's one of the best. And so reading the Odyssey was what really did it for me.
Interesting. Well, I read the Odyssey when I was in high school, and then I did take a classics course in college and read the Iliad and the Odyssey again. And in high school, I was a slog. It wasn't that interesting to me. In college, it really came alive for me. Do you think it has to do with a teacher?
I think it can depend on the teacher, but I think, you know, looking at being a teacher of college students, there's a light bulb that just clicks on with a lot of college kids in that transition from being 16, 17 to being 18 or 19. Maybe it's just being away from home. Maybe it's being able to explore. So there's I find a huge curiosity about the ancient world in college students. At Luther College, where I teach, our courses in mythology and history and Latin are just overflowing. And this is not unique to us. It's true at colleges all in Iowa and all around the country. If people out there are worried that young people nowadays are just forgetting all about the past and forgetting our classical heritage, it's not true. there's a huge interest, more so than when I was in college, from young people about the classical world.
Now, one time when we spoke before about one of your books, I think it was about the gods, I brought up the Percy Jackson series, which has been incredibly popular by Rick Riordan, and it's about children that are supposedly half divine, so they are the children of the gods who have had children with mortals. They're demigods, and there's a camp. There are a couple camps. Anyway, very convoluted. Yeah. But have you read those books?
I read the first one, which I really enjoyed. I think his books are really good, and I recommend them to young people.
And they've been around long enough that you must have college students who are coming into school who've read them,
right? Oh, my goodness, yes. College students who've read that, college students who grew up on the Disney movie Hercules. And so, there's a huge interest from college students based on these popular culture books and movies.
Do you feel like this is a part of a resurgence of interest in the classics?
Well, I think so. I think Harry Potter's actually had a lot to do with it, too, because it has so many classical references in it, and all the magic spells are basically Latin.
Right.
I think there's and people who've read C.S. Lewis or J.R.R. Tolkien, who are great classical scholars, there is a great passion. I don't think it ever died away, but I think that there is now a passion for learning about classics more than there was, I think, when I was in college 30 years ago or more.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I've been talking with Philip Freeman. He's a classics professor at Luther College, author of many books, and he's just released a new translation of Cicero's How to Grow Old. Coming up in a moment, we're going to talk about another part of the ancient world. We'll talk about 6th century Ireland. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, my guest is Philip Freeman. He is a classics professor at Luther College, the author of many books. He has just recently released a translation of Cicero's How to Grow Old, and we're going to talk about his also most recent novel, which is called Sacrifice. It's a Celtic adventure, here in just a moment. But Philip, before we move on from Cicero, we have Skippy on the line in Des Moines. Hello, Skippy.
Yeah. Hey. Good morning.
Hi.
No, I'm laughing in my car because I'm 63 years old, and like many my age, I was stuck in classic rock land. And as far as music was concerned, I was recovering from an operation, and I just started searching music, and just found out that I really enjoy alternative young English group, kind of like festival bands and things like that. And I'm just laughing because if I were to mention them to the people, my friends my age, they would think that I'm absolutely nuts. And if I were to mention it to young people, I'm afraid they would think I was just creepy. So I would be curious to know if Cicero is around today. Would he just say, you know, just suck it up, keep it to yourself, and just enjoy. So I just thought it was funny. That's all.
Well, Skippy, thank you so much for your call. It does sound like you and Cicero are thinking right along the same lines, Philip.
I think Cicero would say that's fine. I sometimes will creep out and watch these teenage apocalyptic movies at the local theater and get a big kick out of those. So I shouldn't have said that on the radio, but I do.
Well, it sounds like maybe Skippy should talk to some young people if he wants to follow Cicero's
sure,
advice.
Sure, I think so.
All right. And perhaps Skippy is inspired by Scipio. I don't know. Skippy, thank you so much for your call. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you have thoughts on Cicero, you're welcome to join the conversation. But we are going to turn the conversation a little bit to 6th century Ireland, which this is another part of the ancient world that you have studied extensively, right?
Yes, I did. And I got interested in this, I think, through classical mythology. I started reading Celtic and Irish mythology as well when I was in college. And so when I went to graduate school, I did something at Harvard I don't think anybody had ever done before. And I got a joint PhD in classics and Celtic studies. So I ended up doing Greek and Latin, but I also did a lot of Irish as well. And ever since I graduated, I've been teaching and working and writing about both subjects.
Now, acquaint us just a little bit. I know that we could talk for an entire hour about this culture, but in your novel, you write quite a bit about Druids, and also, of course, the main character in your novel is a Christian nun. So this is kind of a cultural clash. Is this something that was happening in the 6th century, this transition between the ancient and the modern?
Absolutely. St. Patrick, who was a real person, came into Ireland in the 5th century and started preaching Christianity along with a lot of others. But it didn't take hold real quickly. And there were plenty of non-Christians around for centuries, and there were plenty of Druids around too. And the Druids were just the native pre-Christian Celtic priests who were officiants at the various native Celtic religions of the times. And they were a people with a long tradition and great wisdom and great scientific curiosity, too, and philosophical as well. So it was a clash of ideas. It was a Christian world coming into a pagan world.
What do we know about the Druids? Is there much? I mean, I know there's an archaeological record, but is there much of a record that we can actually draw from to know what they knew and how they practiced?
There's not a whole lot, but there is some. Julius Caesar, for example, writes about the Druids, and a number of different classical authors do. And then when we move into Ireland in the early Christian period, we also have mentions of Druids. They tend not to be so favorable because they were the competition. But although we don't know a whole lot about the Druids, we do know enough to get a fairly good shape of their beliefs and their thoughts about the world and about religion.
Now, when we think about the Druids, I guess for a lot of us, probably Stonehenge comes to mind. Are we in the right zone?
We're in the right zone. We're not in the right time period.
Okay.
Stonehenge actually was built probably centuries and centuries before the Celts ever arrived in Britain. Although the Druids may well have used Stonehenge, and certainly on the summer solstice, for example, you see a lot of modern day Druids who like to gather at Stonehenge, and that's fine. It's just that the Druids that I'm talking about in the book, and the Druids who were part of Celtic society, are really more in the first millennium BC and then the first few centuries AD.
Now, you've written some wonderful nonfiction books over the years, introducing classical individuals and history to so many of us. And now this is a series of novels that, and I love describing it to people, because a 6th century nun solving murder mysteries that's a great pitch. But how on earth did you come up with this idea?
This was so much fun. I've never had so much fun doing anything in my life as writing these two books, these two little novels. They're really mystery books. I've always been a huge Agatha Christie fan, so I thought Murder on the Orient Express, you know, how can I move that to medieval Ireland? And so I came up with this idea because I was working on the manuscripts, Latin manuscripts of the life of St. Bridget, who was an amazing woman who lived at this time period in Ireland, and she founded a monastery for men and women and was very progressive in many ways. So I started thinking, you know, what would it be like if there was a murder series set at this time period, this time of great conflict between Christians and non-Christians, where the classical world is ending and where the medieval world is beginning. And so I just I went from there and just had a great time doing this.
Now, just turning the first page of this novel, the tone is distinctly modern. Was that a decision that you made in writing dialogue that, I mean, this could have come out of a novel set in 2016.
I did that very deliberately because I didn't want it to sound stilted. I didn't want it to sound like Lord of the Rings, some of the dialogue in there, because people in the 6th century, when they were talking among themselves, talked like normal people. And so how best to represent that? These and thous? No, that's not the way. Just to do it like we would talk today, like we're talking right now on the radio. So I wanted it that tone, that register of language in writing the book.
Well, and your characters would have been speaking in Irish, right?
Yes, they would have. My heroine is Sister Deirdre, the nun, who would have spoken Irish, but she, like all Christians of the time, all monks and nuns, probably would have spoken pretty decent Latin as well.
Oh, interesting. So as you decided that you would give this a modern feel, how did this idea really formulate in your mind? I mean, with your other books, the writing process is probably, I would guess, a fairly straightforward of doing research organizing it and writing these chapters. But a novel's got to be completely different.
It is. And writing a nonfiction book is very much like an expanded version of a research paper that everybody who went to college has done. But writing nonfiction is different. And what I did, and people will do it different ways. Some people will just start off with chapter one and just see where it goes from there. Other people will outline it very carefully. I was somewhere in between that. And I knew what I wanted to happen. I had outlined the basics of it. But then as I went along, something would pop into my head, and I thought, you know, that would be a really good thing to put here. And so I did. And so it's a much more, I think, like painting a portrait than it is like doing a research paper.
Would you read us a little bit from the novel?
I will. And this is the scene where there's a series of murders in this. There's a serial killer loose. And this is when they first discover the second victim.
And I've got to say, it gets to be very, it feels like a forensics drama on television a little bit as they...
Yes, my mother didn't like this one. She liked my first one, but she said this was just a little too gruesome. So,
all right.
But anyway, the naked body of a young woman was tied with thick ropes to the broken trunk of the tree. A crow that had been perched on her right shoulder had flown away when we came near. Signs and emblems, all of which I knew were sacred druid symbols, had been carved into the flesh around her breasts with a knife, but there was no head on the body. On the sharp point at the top of the tree, higher than I could reach, was the missing head of the woman, fixed as if on a pike. The golden blonde hair was blowing in the wind, wrapping itself thickly around her face. Others from the monastery were running to the tree now, including Sister Anna, who came and stood with us. I could also see Father Albie coming down the path as fast as he could. And so it goes on from there, and they discover the identity of this second victim.
There's a... I think, in my mind, a pretty clear parallel between some of the conflicts that we have today, where we have, in this case, an ancient religion and people acting out in the name of this ancient religion in a way that the other druids don't approve of. And the Christians are pretty quick to say, hey, this is because they're druids. I mean, that I can see a clear parallel with today's political conflicts. Was that in your mind as well?
It was. And I was thinking about this as I wrote it about Islamic terrorism, but not just Islamic. It could just as easily be Christian terrorism, too. And the inability of people to talk to each other and to appreciate the heritage. And so one thing I have Sister Deirdre, who is a Christian but who comes from a Druidic heritage, I have her trying to build a bridge between these different cultures. And I don't want to give away the end of the story, but I think she succeeds to a certain extent in the end of it. So, oh yeah, I was definitely thinking about modern times.
The book is Sacrifice, A Celtic Adventure. Is this series going to continue? This is the second book in the series.
It is. I'm planning and hoping to write a third one and to get started this summer.
Let's go back to the phones. The number to call if you would like to join our conversation is 866-780-9100. Jim is on the line in Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
Greetings. Salutations.
Thanks for being here. What would you like to talk about?
Well, of course, having heard him now I have two things to talk about.
All right.
The first was that there's a book called Inferno that is a modern retelling of Dante's Inferno. And when I was back in college at Iowa State University, I lent it to my English professor, who lent it to the guy at the university who taught Dante, who told her that he was going to have everyone in his class read this book first so that they would know what Dante was talking about.
So read the modern interpretation first.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Oh, yeah.
I read it in college too. Is it Larry Pornell? I forget exactly who it is, but
Jerry Pornell.
Yes, it's just wonderful.
Interesting.
And the second is that with the Druidic influences in Ireland in the 6th century, one thing to remember is one reason that the Irish Church is so prudish, shall we say, is because it spent these centuries competing with the more sensual, shall we say, rituals of local pagans, like Lugnasa and planting festivals and all this other stuff. So that's just something to keep in mind when you're reading this. It's not just a conflict. It's how the two different cultures do affect each other, including the one that eventually won out but still had to react to this original influence.
Well, Jim, thanks a lot for your call. Philip, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, that's absolutely true, that in pre-Christian Irish culture, it was looser, I guess you could say. They had all sorts of different grades of marriage, all sorts of different reasons for divorce that the Catholic Church, the Christian Church, objected to. A woman could easily divorce her husband in ancient Ireland if, for example, he became too fat to get her pregnant. That was just the sort of thing that didn't go well with the Catholic Church.
Fascinating. Well, it's interesting that Jim brought up the book Inferno, that for so many apparently was an entree into Dante's Inferno. Do you see these books as an entree for people into the ancient world of Celts?
Oh, I hope so. I want people to read St. Bridget's Bones, to read Sacrifice, but then to go into to learn more about the ancient Celtic world. It's very much unappreciated, this marvelous, great culture. For people to learn more about Celtic mythology. Actually, I just happen to be finishing a book on Celtic mythology right now. Should be out in about a year, so something to look for.
All right. Well, we'll definitely talk about that when it comes out as well. Are you already hearing from people who've picked up these novels and are wanting to know more?
I am. Aside from my mother, I've heard from
she didn't want that.
But yeah, I've heard from a number of people who'd really enjoyed it and hoped that I would write another. So I'm sure planning on it.
And you're thinking about the novel for the summer. What? And you're working on Celtic mythology. You're an incredibly prolific writer, and I know that you've talked about how you just love your work in the classroom. What do you get out of sharing this work with a broader audience? What drives you? Because clearly you've been investing a lot of hours writing.
Well, really, it's an extension of the classroom to me. I love teaching, and I can only teach 100 people a semester or so, but if I can write books, then potentially a whole lot more can read, and I can reach a lot more folks.
What other areas are you hoping to explore, or is it more of Greek and Roman history and more of Celtic history?
Well, I'm looking ahead to another Cicero translation. He did a wonderful book about friendship and the importance of friendship. So I'd like to do a translation in the same series about that. I would certainly like to do more about more Sister Deirdre mystery books. Those would be fun. But then maybe expand into the mythology of, say, ancient Egypt or ancient Norse mythology. There's so much to be learned.
Well, Philip Freeman, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
Philip Freeman is a classics professor at Luther College. He has written many books, but the most recent ones are his translation of Cicero's How to Grow Old, Ancient Wisdom for the Second Half of Life. You can read it in Latin in his translation, but you don't have to. Also, his latest novel is Sacrifice, a Celtic Adventure. It's the second in his series about a scrappy 6th century Irish nun who has a knack for solving mysteries. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had help today from Tony Daner. And we'd love to hear from you. If you have suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show, send us an email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'd also love to hear from you on Twitter. You can follow us on Twitter @IPR Talk or on Facebook. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.